Of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is a Thursday. That means it is time for an expert counsel Q&A. This will be episode 3494 of the Survival Podcast, and being it's a Thursday, it is going to be an expert counsel Q&A here for Thursday, May the 9th. I've got a good lineup for you today. They got like six expert segments and then my anchor segment at the end. Ron Paul and Chris Rossini with the Ron Paul Liberty Report highlights for the week. That's a simple question. Are we going to start trading opinions as crimes? Has Congress lost their minds? What they've lost is their ethics and their morals long ago. And I'll have a little follow-up on that, but it ties very well into my anchor segment today. Which is not going to sound like it at first, but it will, you'll see. Nick Ferguson will talk about the germination and propagation of something called the horse chestnut. Those are not for eating, by the way. Andy McCann will talk about how to get better sleep and quiet your mind. I'll have a little assist on that. Dr. Ken Berry will talk about dealing with epilepsy in children. Eric Hammond will talk about AC for a car that never had AC in it. And that's actually a pretty tall order in some situations. We'll see about this specific one when Eric talks. Ben Falk will talk about stopping erosion in a land that has a sandy soil environment, specifically lawn, that won't hold together. And I'm going to talk about a little addition to what Ben says. I think Ben's advice is great, but I got one little addition that might really help this problem. And then I'm going to talk about why I feel we're closer to a breakup of American states than most people realize. I'm not saying this is something that's going to happen tomorrow, but I promise you 2 years before the Soviet Union broke up, if you had told somebody in the Soviet Union that the Soviet Union would soon be a relic of history, they'd not have believed you. And I don't think it would have mattered if you were talking to somebody in Belarus or Lithuania or Ukraine or Estonia or someone near Moscow or someone, you know, way out in eastern Russia, out towards Siberia. Or even all the way out, like the Pacific side of Russia, in the frigid, you know, ocean cold. I think anywhere you would have asked within the Soviet Union, they would have said, no, that's not going to happen. And I'm not going to draw a direct corollary between the two, because they're different situations. The analogy there is only that you can be sure a thing cannot occur that can be incredibly momentous in size and scope and, you know, literally change the globe. And you can be sure there's no way it can happen, and it can. I mean, this was something unique for me. I was in Honduras and Panama when most of the complete breakdown and fall apart of the Soviet era happened. And, you know, I was a very young man. I joined the army when I was 17. When I got out, you know, I was in 3 years. And I wasn't quite old enough to buy beer when I got out of the Army. That's how young I was. Sometimes people say, you know, you talk about it a lot for it only being such a short part of your life. But it's where I grew up. It's where I became a man. And I don't mean like, go send a guy off to the Army, he comes back a man. I mean like when you go from 17 to 21, basically, because I came back like a couple months before my birthday. That's when you become a man. And so in those formative years, those were the people I was surrounded by. And that's why I probably invoke it as much as I do still today. It's been more years since I got out than it was, you know, my whole life up until I got in and served. But there is something that is unique, I think, about just being completely divorced and disconnected from the news, the scuttlebutt of the world and all. Because you were soldiers. You would think that we really paid attention to this. We did not. There was one TV station we could get. It was the AFIS TV station. They didn't talk about it much, and we didn't watch it much. I probably watched less TV in my time in Panama than I watched ever in my life, up to and including now. And in Honduras, I watched, like, we watched the Super Bowl because they brought in a satellite dish and put the Super Bowl on in a big giant tent for us to watch the Super Bowl. That was the entire 6 months I was there. We watched television, if you want to call it that, one time. They set it up for Super Bowl only. So when I came back to the States in 1993, the entire world literally had changed. I came home, and one of the things I remembered is there were these big hunks of like graffiti-coated chunks of concrete that were sitting on one of the bookshelves in my grandparents' house. And I had no idea what it was. My uncle Mike, my oldest uncle and my dad's older brother, had gone to Germany after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And they, you know, like street vendors were selling chunks of the Berlin Wall as souvenirs. And there were several chunks of the Berlin Wall sitting in that house. And you can say that, you know, you must have been really ill-informed. Well, I was. I was freaking 20 years old. I didn't give a shit. I wasn't, I guess I had heard about it, but it wouldn't really made sense to me that that thing that I learned about in, 1987 in high school, this thing that would be there and separate people forever was gone. And the first Olympics after I got home, when I heard teams being introduced from, Lithuania, Ukraine, et cetera, I knew it by then, obviously, but it was strange to me. Having grown up with, like, the greatest Olympic moment of all time was the Americans defeating the Russians, and so much so that people thought of it, even though it wasn't, they thought of it as the gold medal match in the Winter Olympics in the, was it 70s or was it 82? It was 82, I guess, or 84? I don't remember. I don't remember when that Olympics was. Back then, the Olympics were the same year. Winter and summer were in the same year. Now they split them up. So I was at 76. I don't even remember. But that was like such an iconic thing. I'm sure those of you that are my age remember going to arcades. And they had the big, hockey game where with the dome. And it was always the U.S. versus Russia, right? That was the biggest thing in the world, except it was the Soviet Union. And so I'm looking at this country today and going, in many ways, we are far more divided and we have far more trouble amongst ourselves than the Soviets and what we would call today their satellite republics did in the 80s. And so I'll talk about that. That was a longer lead up to introducing Ron Paul than I expected today, but just kind of waxing nostalgic there a little bit to how much the world has changed since I was a high school kid, since I was a young soldier, and then since I was a young man, having come back to this country and had to start building a career. It's kind of crazy where we are today. And hopefully that'll frame things well for when I get to my anchor segment at the end today. With that, let's hear from Chris Rossini and Dr. Paul. Treating opinions as crimes. Has Congress lost their minds?
But the hate speech, it shouldn't surprise us, Chris, that they've been talking, about this and the problem. It shouldn't surprise us. Oh, the government has a solution to that. There's too much hate speech, and that's terrible. And we're going to discipline them. And that's why we need more laws. And we don't know how to define hate speech. But it's related in some way to Lysander Spooner's argument that the views that people have and opinions that people have are not crimes. Crimes are quite a bit different. That's when you hurt and kill and, this sort of thing. But he said there's a big difference. He said a vice is treated elsewhere. It's a personal, moral shortcoming.
That's right, Dr. Paul. Yes, as you point out, hate is merely an opinion. We hate here at the Ron Paul Liberty Report when the government breaks its own laws, the U.S. Constitution. They do it every day. We hate that. Now, that's our opinion. There's other people that they love it. They love it when the government breaks the law, especially if they think it'll benefit them. But opinions are not a crime. Opinions can't be touched by legislation. Opinions are thoughts. Now, of course, there are distasteful opinions. But when there are distasteful opinions, you want those to be out in the open. You want the truth to come out. Whoa, that's not true. Let me explain to you the truth. So it can be countered when there are distasteful opinions. Legislation, when you make it a crime, you're basically pretending that opinion does not exist. Think back at COVID. They were trying, don't mention natural immunity. The media, don't print it. Don't talk about it. Let's try to deny that it even exists. Now, did natural immunity go anywhere? Absolutely not. In fact, natural immunity prevailed despite their attempt to censor the truth. So, you know, the best way to counter speech that is nasty, distasteful, even immoral, is to have more free speech, not try to make opinions, thoughts criminal, because that is the quickest road to tyranny. Once opinions are turned into crimes, boy, does that open the door for every nasty thing you could imagine. You know, and it's so disappointing watching Republican Congress, you know, with this anti-Semitism bill that so many people are saying this is the craziest thing that has ever been passed by the House of Representatives, because it opens a door. If this were to become law, you know, if the left gets into power, they could turn anything into hate speech, anything that they don't like, anything that comes out of Republicans' mouth can be deemed hate speech. That's the door that you're opening. And in case you didn't notice, the left is very good at gaining power and holding on to power. That's their specialty. They're not good at creating their utopias. They never do that. But as when it comes to gaining power and holding on to it, you know, is this who you want to define what hate speech is? You won't be able to. Suppose you have a problem with an election and you want to go out and protest. Too bad. You're a Nazi who hates our democracy. Hate speech. Clear them out. Is that what Republicans want? They better really think before they open this Pandora's box, because it will be used against them so hard that their head will spin.
You know, it is the case that often those who are most damaged by regulation in a society are those that helped institute the regulation and should have known better at the time that they did it, but they thought, no, it'll be okay. And like I said, this will tie really good into my segment at the end, where we're going to talk about how close this country might actually be to a complete and total breakup, one way or another, of the country into regions or two disparate areas or something like that. Because this is why I said this fits perfectly. This is exactly the type of thing that I woke up thinking about this morning, which is why I decided to talk about it. And the idea that you can regulate speech in a nation that has enshrined freedom thereof in their constitution, in fact, did so the First Amendment to that constitution, right? So I see people talk about the First Amendment, but you should think about the order of the amendments. You really should. So they put this constitution in place, which was a radical departure from how any nation had governed itself anytime recently in the world anyway. We were still in a feudal system for most of the world and a slave-based system for a lot of the rest of the world. And in many places, you had feudalism and slavery coexistent in much of the world when we enshrined the Constitution as our form of government here in the country. And then we said, but it's not enough. There was actually debate about the Bill of Rights, and a concept that if we did the Bill of Rights, then it would be used in the future to say, since it's not specifically prohibited by the Constitution, the government can do it. The other side, the side that won, said, yeah, and they're going to do that anyway, so we better do this. And the first thing they said was that the press was to be free and the speech of the people were to be free. The second thing they said is, and the people of the country shall have the ability to defend that through the use of arms, should it become necessary, so that they, one, can prevent overreach by the state, but two, will not be dependent on the state for the most basic security that they need for themselves. Yeah. We now have people that are hostile to the Constitution openly and directly, who at the same time have sworn an oath to uphold and defend the same. And I will let that speak for itself until later when I talk about the propensity for a complete total breakup in the country. And I know many of you heard me talk about America collapsing as an empire. I want to be clear, as I set the stage for that at the end, those are different things. You can have an empire collapse without a nation breaking up. But if a nation breaks up, you will have an empire. If that nation was the head of an empire, that empire will collapse. It's going to be interesting times in the not-so-distant future. But let's talk about something totally different now. Let's say you want a bunch of trees. You want big, big, giant, beautiful trees. Not for food, because don't eat these things. And it is not a good food. Now, horse chestnut actually is a decent medicinal, but it's the type of medicinal that really needs to be professionally refined into that medicinal to be safe. So I would not even go doing a whole lot of self-crafting of herbal remedies with horse chestnut. But it is a big, beautiful, gorgeous tree, and it's pretty easy, actually, to propagate. Nick Ferguson will talk about exactly how you do that.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com here with an expert counsel answer for Calvin. He says, Ben Falk or Jeff Lawton or the most appropriate expert. Question, please provide advice on germinating horse chestnut seeds, conkers. As the details are, three different web pages recommend three different methods. Kind regards, Calvin. Well, that's a quick and easy answer, Calvin. I'm going to give you the simplest answer first and then a longer explanation with details if you want to maximize your results and geekiness. Simply throw the conkers, the nuts, the seeds, whatever you want to call them, in some potting mix, in pots, cover with some hardware cloth and rocks to keep critters from eating them during the winter, water them, and set them in your nursery area until spring. That's the easiest and simplest answer. That's basically it. But you might be somewhere where that's not possible, or you might be trying to save seed from a special tree and you don't have many seeds to use. If that's the case, then I'd put all the seeds in a bucket of water, pick out the floating ones, as they're probably trash. I'd put about a cup of hydrogen peroxide per gallon of water in the bucket and let them soak for about 10 minutes. That's going to kill off a lot of spores and diseases on the shells and hopefully set you up for a little bit better success. Set all the heavy ones that sank to the side and then use some sterile seed starting mix or vermiculite and some distilled water to moisten it only as moist as birthday cake. It can't be super wet and it shouldn't leave your hands dry after handling it. If you squeeze, you should get water out of it, but not make a huge mess. It can't be saturated or else they'll just die. Mix the seeds and soil or vermiculite and there should be about 3 to 4 times as much soil mix as seeds. Put that in plastic baggies that are labeled with the start date and end date, what's in the bag, where you got the seed from, that kind of details, and then put those bags in the fridge where they won't freeze, like in your veggie drawer, for instance. You're shooting for between 36 degrees and 46 degrees Fahrenheit, with the optimal temperature being spot on at 43 degrees Fahrenheit. If you can manage a steady 43, they should be done with stratification in about 45 to 50 days. But if it's warmer, a longer stratification is great. 100 days in the fridge isn't too long. They will germinate fastest and best at around 95 degrees. Great questions from the audience, as always. Keep them coming. And I am planning a consulting tour through a couple places in the USA this June. I'll be in Texas, probably Tennessee, maybe as far east as Georgia. So shoot me an email if you're wanting to get put on the notification list for consulting. I'm Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty. Do good things.
Good stuff from Nick Ferguson. It reminds me of a story from my childhood. And I've never been able to locate this tree. As I realized in my later life that it was not, in fact, a horse chestnut, but a chestnut. Now, could it have been some sort of Chinese hybrid? I don't know, but this kind of gives hope that somewhere out there, there's an American chestnut tree that is resistant or completely immune to blight. I found a chestnut tree behind a house that my father bought when we moved to Pennsylvania from Florida. Not the place he lives now that I'm always talking about, my grandparents' homestead. This was a relatively new house. There was a patch of woods between it. And I have been back to Pennsylvania since. The last time would have been in the early 2000s. And I went and I tried to find this tree. But I remember finding a chestnut tree in the woods and telling my grandfather about it and having him convince me that I was wrong. My grandfather was a very wise old man. And that it was clearly a horse chestnut, that it couldn't possibly have been a chestnut. Now, he was actually old enough to have remembered the chestnut blight, right? It's kind of crazy when you think about it. But I realized after being gone and thinking about and looking up, you know, in later life, what a horse chestnut looked like. This was a chestnut tree. This was a legit chestnut tree. And it really has no direct relevance, but it just made me think of it. And sometimes I can share those memories. Somewhere out there, I believe there are American chestnuts that are resistant to the blight that don't necessarily have to be GMO'd or crossed or hybridized or anything like that. They do exist. Next up, let's talk about getting better sleep with Andy McCann, and this is one I'll tag team a little bit in on.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann with CrossFit Garage out here in Woodstock, Georgia, and I'm here to answer your health and fitness questions. And I got a pretty good one today. I'm going to summarize the question, but it's basically, here it goes. It's, how do I get more sleep? My biggest issue is that I don't feel tired at night, and when I do lay down, my thoughts spiral all around. Thank you, Nick from Texas. And so what I'm going to do is list out for you some of the things that I did on another podcast that I have on my own. So my podcast uniquely is called CrossFit Garage, and I'll link it. Maybe Jack can put it in the show notes and you can find it. Or just search for CrossFit Garage, and there's a whole episode on this. I think it's about 45 minutes long. I'm going to give you the 18 items that I have in there. I'm just going to run through them, but I'm going to focus in on what Nick asked for about being tired and mind spiraling out of control. Okay, so on those two things, the first thing that I have found, the best fix I have ever found about I'm not tired when I go to sleep, is wake up at 5 a.m. and don't go to bed until 11 p.m. And then wake up at 5 a.m. and don't go to bed until 11 p.m. And yeah, you get what's going to happen. Wake up at 5 a.m. and I promise you on the third day, you're going to be like, dude, I am so tired, and go to bed. But then wake up at 5 a.m. or 6 a.m., whatever is going to be the right thing. But at the beginning, make it tough on yourself so that you are getting tired. So if you find yourself getting into that tired phase, and I'm just, man, I want to take a nap. Don't take a nap. Don't drink a lot of coffee. You know, let yourself experience the tired. Go to bed and then wake up. Okay, so the next one was, my thoughts spiral around. So I have two things that I've done for me, and I'm going to lay them out. You're going to have to kind of pick which one's going to work for you. So the first thing I did was put a notepad out, because it was more like business ideas and things I wanted to do. So I would reach over and write down whatever it was on a notepad. And then it felt freeing, like, okay, I got it down. I can go to sleep rather than let it keep going. So I just reach over and jot it down. It doesn't have to be neat. I had a little light that I would, you know, shine, and I would just write and be like, okay, I'm good. I'm going back to bed. And I did that for a while, and it finally stopped happening so that I could mostly get a full night's sleep. The next thing I did, which has helped out a whole lot, is listen to some sort of podcast that I don't really care about, that I just do for fun. So for me, I listen to a Dungeon Crawl Classics podcast right now, and I've set it to go for about 45 minutes, and then it turns itself off. So I listen to that. I just have the earplugs in, or if my wife's out of town, then I'll just let it play loud. And I just let that kind of feed my mind, and then I go to bed. Actually, the third thing that I've used in the past was pretty good, is very similar. There is a system out there called relaxation or guided meditation podcasts or episodes or whatever it is you can get. So let me pull the one up that I use on my phone. I'll tell you what it is. All right, the one that I used for a long time was Guided Meditations for Deep Sleep. And they've got the same run of words or the things they talk about. There's a 45 minute one, and then they just start cutting it down. You can go all the way down from 45 to 30 to 15 to 5. And I would play the 45 minute one and just follow through. And what it does is it just takes your mind through a scenario that helps you relax. And then as you get used to it, it's sort of just teaching yourself to relax. Okay. Now, what are the 18 things that you can do to help yourself sleep? First is stick to a consistent sleep schedule. So that's the whole wake up at 6, go to bed at 10. Create a relaxing bedtime routine, like read a book or whatever. I wouldn't watch TV or do scrolling in bed, but some sort of routine. I brush my teeth, I floss, or vice versa, and then I read something, then I go to bed. Limited exposure to screens, we just talked about that. Create a comfortable sleep environment, so make sure you actually like sleeping in your bed. If you hate your bed or your pillows, change those out. Invest in a comfortable mattress and pillow. Be mindful of your diet. Yeah, so that's a huge one for me. I know if I drink water after 7 p.m., I'm going to be getting up a lot. Get regular exercise. Yep, this is kind of the world I live in. So start exercising. Anything's better than nothing. Manage stress. Limit your naps. So if you can't go to sleep and you're taking a nap, I mean, seriously, there's a problem right there, right? So you need a nap for some reason, and it's ruining your sleep time. Establish a bedtime ritual. Limit the fluid intake before bed. Yep, that's me. Be mindful of your medications. Set the right temperature. Usually it's like 66 degrees is what they say the optimal temperature is. I don't know. You're going to have to experiment with that for yourself. Invest in a quality mattress and bedding. consider a weighted blanket. I hate weighted blankets, but three of the people in my family love weighted blankets and it was a game changer. Use white noise or brown noise or something sort of sound machine. We've got a fan that we spin all the time, so we've got just a little box fan. You can also put things on your phone, like there's this thing called iDreams, and it's got a whole bunch of different music or sounds you can do. Keep the pets out of the bedroom. Kids, too. Limit your light exposure. Okay, those are 18 things you can do, and you can go on my podcast and listen to it. It's called 18-ish Actions to Fix Your Sleep. I think there's a couple more actually in the podcast that I give you, and it is an episode that was, it's episode 67, which I put out on August 15th, 2023. All right, guys, hope that helps. Again, you can find me, CrossFitGarage.com, or online, or email me, Andy at CrossFitGarage.com, and YouTube at AndyMcCann42. Y'all take care. Happy sleeping.
So Andy did hit this in the routine part, and I think that is helpful to have, like, when I go to bed, these are the things I do before I go to bed and as I go to bed. But one of the things he mentioned was reading, and I find this to be one of the most useful things personally myself. I have a business mind, and I have a problem-solving mind. So it is natural for me when I stop doing things to start running through my head, well, what show am I going to do tomorrow? If I know what I'm going to talk about, start running through scripts in my mind. And I think this might be one of those things that's like a blessing and a curse. It was crazy to me a few years ago when stuff came out about the fact that not everybody has an internal dialogue. And I talked to my wife and she's like, I don't. And I'm like, are you? It's almost impossible for me to understand that you don't. And I'm just wondering if we're using different vernaculars. But I guess, like, what's the strength of it? And what I mean by that is, like, when you read a book, do you sort of, and see, this is where I'm wondering if it's a translation issue, hear it in your head as you read it. Right? Do you think of what the voice would sound like if the character is speaking? Do you kind of think that, okay, this is a female, that, and you kind of hear a feminine voice imagined in your mind, and so you don't actually hear it. It's not like an audible thing, but it's there. And I think people that have this, and specifically people that use this to literally have internal conversations to solve problems, to plan a next move, to sit, to go through a thing, it may be that that's very advantageous to us. Because everybody I've talked to that's like a high net income person who doesn't have just like a job that just works out that way. Like, you went to school, you got a PhD, and now you work for a company that pays you a lot of money. Like, people that have actually built companies, whether they did it as an entrepreneur or not. But, I mean, the kind of people that actually plan, move, and build companies, almost all of them say that they do. And so I think it's advantageous to have this for that purpose, but I think it can turn around and bite you with learning to be quiet in the mind, because your mind is naturally not quiet. And what I have found is the number one way I have to shut that off is reading. And when I read, I need to read something that's absolutely positively fanciful. I cannot read a book on soil science and go to sleep. It will get me to the point where I'm like, oh, I'm done. Like, okay, this is boring. It's a lot of Latin. But when I shut it off, then it's, oh, wow, with what I just learned, what does that mean about my soil or my class that I'm building or something like that, right? But if I read something like a Star Trek book that, or, you know, something like that, sci-fi, fantasy fiction, something like that, then it is such a departure from what I care about getting done that it stops it. And that's been pretty advantageous to me. The other thing I would say is I have two products that both are fantastic for sleep, but I can see some people wouldn't want to maybe become dependent on a product, especially a substance like cannabis. But the two of them are, one is from Acura Botanicals. They make a Delta 8 blue gummy. And I'm going to say, if you try this product, please cut the damn thing in half when you first use it, because some people eat one and it's fine, and some people eat one and it just knocks the piss out of them. But it's actually a deep sleep product is what it's marketed as. And I would say with cannabis edibles, I'm pretty much a go-to-sleep guy anyway, even the stuff that's supposed to be more energizing. But that thing, man, not only do I sleep so heavy, I know that I dream, but I don't remember dreaming. It's like a dreamless sleep but you know you dream because you have to dream frequently or it actually messes things up in your life. So I know I'm dreaming. It's just you're so deep you don't remember that you dreamed. That's a deep sleep. And, of course, Delta 8 is the cannabinoid that is a THC cannabinoid that can get you high. Though high is not how I would describe this. Drowsy is how I would describe this. But it is, you know, it's basically a legal loophole because it's not the Delta 9 THC that's still illegal in many places. Now, the other product is made by a different company, Angie's Gardens. And it is it's a CBD oil that's, you know, you drop it under your tongue and what have you. But it's not just CBD. It's CBD and CBN. CBN is what's known as the master cannabinoid. In other words, all the cannabinoids in cannabis start out as CBN, and then there's this kind of way that things shift and change, and they become all this, like 111 or 130-some or 109. It's 100-and-something cannabinoids that are in cannabis, but they all begin from CBN. This is like the mother cannabinoid. And it is an incredible sleep aid. It is more powerful than Valium. It has no addictive tendencies. It has no real side effect except your ass is going to sleep. It's also in the strength necessary to be effective, somewhat expensive. And again, the company is called Angie's Gardens. Here's the good news. Angie's Gardens and Acura Botanicals both do MSB discounts. If you're going to use these products with any regularity, either company's discount will pay for your MSB plus in any given year. And I know cannabis is not something everybody wants to mess with, and honestly, maybe not everybody should. What I'm telling you is I've used both these products. I've never had any problems, but when I say sleep, I mean sleep. And these are not things to be messing around with until you're home and you know you're going to bed. You do not need to be driving, operating heavy machinery, playing with your pet tiger, anything like that if you're using these. These are legal. I don't have any kind of, like, if I don't use them for a couple weeks, I'm not like, oh, I'm jonesing or something. So they don't have any problems like that, at least for me. But what I will tell you is that they do what they promise, and that's good if you use them correctly, and it can be bad if you don't. And again, I'm going to say this to all of you that are open to doing this that never have. When it comes to edibles, you cannot treat, I don't care what you've smoked, you can't treat it the same way. It hits incredibly differently, and always start with less. You can always add more, and if you do less, don't just do more. Right? Like, give it time, because sometimes people take 45 minutes to an hour to really start to experience the effects of edibles. Some people go much quicker, but most people will not peak in the effect until about 2 hours into it. So you can go on this journey if you wish to, but you can always try more next time. But you can't get it out once it goes in, and it is a different experience altogether. Just saying. But it does absolutely work for sleep. And the CBN CBD oil from Angie's Garden, I refer to the sleep that comes with that is non-optional. Like, you are going to hell to sleep, at least in my experience. All right, with that, that's longer than I planned to go there. Let's move on. Let's talk about epilepsy with Dr. Ken Berry.
Hello, all you Survival Podcast listeners. This is Dr. Ken Berry today answering a question from Douglas. How can epilepsy be healed in a four-year-old? Our daughter was diagnosed with generalized epilepsy in September after having a seizure, and the EEG showed spike wave patterns. She had a genetic test done, and it came back with TUB2A. Unknown significance. We want to do everything we can to help her heal and to get her off the anti-seizure medication. So you may or may not know, Douglas, that a ketogenic diet has been used to treat seizure disorders since the 1920s. This was the original medical intervention use of a ketogenic diet. Now, for your daughter, you definitely need to keep routine appointments with the pediatric neurologist. You need to ask them about a therapeutic ketogenic diet, and you need to do research about a therapeutic ketogenic diet for epilepsy or seizure disorder. It is absolutely the way your little one needs to be eating. I would recommend the whole family adopt this way of eating, so you're not having to prepare two different meals, or she feels weird eating something different than the rest of the family, because all you guys are going to benefit from eating this. Now, her ketogenic diet is going to need to be very high fat, and you're going to have to check her ketones. She needs to be in deep ketosis to protect her brain from the seizure disorder. Notice I did not say throw her seizure meds in the garbage or ignore the neurologist. I didn't say any of that. Go see the neurologist, follow their recommendations, ask them about keto, print off some research. You can find it very easily on the internet. Take it in, say, I want to look at this. I want to try this for my daughter. Will you help me with you? Will you work with me? There is hope for this little girl, and I want you to not give up. I want you to keep learning about a ketogenic diet used therapeutically for seizure disorders. Hope this helps. I'll talk to you guys next time.
You know, guys, I know that sometimes it seems like every time somebody asks Ken Berry about a health problem, he's like, proper human diet, go carnivore, at least keto. I do want to reinforce what he said. The entire reason we have a keto diet is because it was developed for the treatment of childhood epilepsy. I completely agree with Ken. Don't get rid of your meds and whatever. Keep seeing your neurologist, etc. But I would also say that it is totally within a realm of possibility that if you take a dietary approach, that if you go a significant period of time without any symptoms of epilepsy, to start weaning off some of that medication and see if it takes. Because I've read case study after case study, really case study, anecdotal, you know, we did this with our kid type stories. And it does, and I'll also say this, it doesn't work for everybody. My niece married a gentleman, a really cool guy up in Colorado, really like him. He had three daughters. The eldest daughter has epilepsy. They have tried CBD, which is something that works for a lot of people. It didn't work. They tried a ketogenic diet. It worked some. It was a huge reduction in episodes, but it did not make them go away, even with medication. So this is not something that always works, but it's something that often works. And I always think things that often work that have no risk are worth trying. There's definitely less risk to eating ketogenically than there is to taking serious pharmaceutical medications, in my view anyway. Remember, though, I'm not a doctor. Next up, let's hear from Ben Falk about erosion. I actually had planned to run Eric's segment on AC for a vehicle first, but I don't really have anything to add to Eric's segment, and I do have something to add to Ben's segment. So that'll make my anchor segment completely divorced and separated from merging together. So let's do it that way.
Hey, Jack and all, Ben Falk with Whole Systems Design. And the question about stopping erosion and improving fertility in a large non-garden area in the sandhills of South Carolina. This guy has, guy or gal has 8.5 acres near Camden, South Carolina. A bunch of it's wooded. Some's open. Some of it's sloping. And or some in grass, and then some areas that have really bad erosion. They want to get animals eventually, potentially sheep or goats, to improve fertility. But they're trying to keep areas from washing away. Sand tends to be very erosive, as many of you know. And then you have a second question about recommendations for non-grass lawn in that area. Well, let's start with the second one because it's easier. There are a lot of like steppables, so-called steppable ground covers that aren't grasses. Thyme is one of them. Oregano is another. I've seen thyme like basically replace lawn in sandy, infertile areas like in the Adirondacks near here in New York State. It may not deal with the heat down there, but I feel like there's a good chance it might. So I'd look into thyme. That's a great quote-unquote lawn that's not grass. But I would just look into, like, generally the most drought-tolerant grasses and low-growing ground covers you can find. I'm not familiar that well with that climate, but I would just look at it in that way. You're probably going to have some grass. That's just part of the deal. I mean, turf grasses are, like, the toughest, most able to handle, you know, traffic, and that's kind of why they dominate in heavy mow slash used surfaces, but I don't think that's such a bad thing. And I would also recommend that what you are referring to as weeds a couple times, you should try to identify and potentially look at their value in of themselves. I mean, they're there for a reason. They might be a serious asset. So I wouldn't right off the bat just write off quote unquote weeds as something you don't want. Like some of those may be very valuable plants to actually reducing erosion and be mowable and able to turn into a lawn, to a turf. So, and that goes for the first question as well, which is reducing erosion. Like any plants that happen to be starting in that area of their own accord, volunteer plants, aka weeds, plants you didn't really mean to happen, are, all things being equal, highly valuable. So again, don't write those off. They're there playing a role. Nature abhors a vacuum. Nature tends to self-organize and regenerate rather than be entropic, prone to entropy and disorganizing and erosive. In at least in climates with a decent amount of rainfall, non-brittle climates like you're in, natural systems tend to actually promote revegetation on their own. And we're trying to work with that tendency and not against it, and just assist that tendency, like adding other diversity. But it may be adding, not just, weeding out, so to speak, the diversity and say, hey, this isn't good and we need to add it all. Generally, you want to be building on that diversity, not, seeking to eradicate it and then add something new. As far as preventing the erosion, that's how I would look at it. Use those quote unquote weeds as a resource, as a value, as a starting point, at least as a nurse crop to other plants. I would just try to seed it heavily, and I would start like in February in that climate, or maybe even January. Now is better than not at all, but it's probably starting to get pretty hot down there, which is a hard time to get stuff to grow. So, sorry, a phone call came in. I thought it might have stopped this message. So, yeah, seed it often and lightly with as much tenacious ground cover seed as you see growing in similar places in that region. Clovers tend to be really good, but there's a lot of other species as well. So look around, identify what's there, what grows well in that region. Find a situation you like in that region, in that ecotype. Identify those plants there and start seeding them. That would be my general, best approach. As far as specific species, it's not my climate, so I'll limit it to the ones I mentioned. But you have the questions now in which you can ask to get those species very directly from doing some detective work in your area. Thanks so much and good luck. I would definitely get it all greened up before putting any animals out there. Except maybe ducks and geese, but anything that can scratch like a chicken and anything with a real cloven hoof, like a sheep or a goat, a caprine, or anything like a cow with a full-on larger hoof, you're going to just accelerate the erosion until there's like a permanent green cover. And you may have to even water it. If it's not a reliable rainfall regime happening when you're seeding, you may have to try to spread some water. It sounds like that may be impractical to do. So just have the seed at the ready, and be ready to spread it when the rains come, especially light, prolonged rains, and hopefully not super hot weather. And also, I would do a soil sample. If it's super acidic, which it might be, or alkaline, which I doubt it is, if it's sand, addressing that with some key nutrients, just a little bit, like a homeopathic dose, so to speak, like a little bit of sulfur, a little bit of lime, can go a long way to establishing a more robust system. Good luck to you.
So the one thing that I would think about adding to Ben's advice, which is great, is, and I would reinforce the idea of a polyculture. I don't know how well thyme is going to work as a full-on lawn, and if you ever eventually want to bring animals into that system, I never really looked into it, but I don't think it's like a high-quality ruminant forage, okay? So that may be something that you want to think about using as a piece in a polyculture system, but not necessarily trying to make a turf out of thyme. It should do fine in your climate. Your climate should be more optimum for it than mine, and thyme does just fine here. So anyway, but the thing I would really think about here is micro earthworks. And I want to be clear what I mean by micro. if you do this right, there should be no reason, let's say, that if you're using a tractor or a lawn tractor to mow this property, that it would in any way get in the way if you do what I'm actually talking about doing here. So what I would do, and they don't probably need to be very close together, but let's say, you know, a spacing of 60 to 100 feet, depending on how big this area is, and mark your contour lines. And again, this is one of those, when I say micro, I mean micro, and that'll make sense to say, where you don't really need to think about, like, oh, I want this much space to be interswell space or whatever. Like, it's just more about don't do more than you need. You can always add more. Backfilling a swell is problematic sometimes, right? It's not as simple as just put the dirt back in the ditch. Now, let's talk about the shape of a swell like this. I would make the width of this swell, if you mow, I would make it about the width of your mower deck, or even double the width of your mower deck. I would make it very easy to mow on that flat area that you're going to create. When I say swell here, when it's grown back in, you will barely notice it. There'll be this little undulation in that one spot in the land that the only reason your mind will see it as a swell is because it's on contour and it cuts across the entire contour of the land from one end to the other. That's the only reason you'll see it as anything other than an undulation. I would dig this swell, and the beauty of sand is it's really easy to do, and this could be done literally with something like a grub hoe. In fact, that might be a great tool for it. In fact, a really great tool combination. I'm not a fan of tillers, but this situation, if you do have some turf, this might be a really good situation for a tiller. So you mark your contours, and you run your tiller just one pass back and forth until you have the width of the swell you want, and then you just start pulling, and you want a level bottom. You don't want a ditch. Think of it like I'm going to put a sidewalk on contour across here, and I'm moving enough earth to pour a couple inches of concrete. I'm going to pour sidewalk. Make it a path. Then move the earth to the downgrade side of the swell as normal and level it out so it's also flat. And it should probably be 1.5 times as wide as the swell itself. Maybe 2x, whatever works. And it also needs to be flat. So think of it like a sidewalk and like a step up to another sidewalk. And then plant into that. And the reason I'm going to say to do that is I already know that you do not have erosion everywhere. You have concentrated points of erosion. And this is because even land that looks relatively flat or relatively uniform in slope has basically ridges and valleys, right? Spurs and valleys going down grade. And what happens is water concentrates in those areas and starts erosion there, and then erosion increases over time. Now, this is probably actually less of a problem in sand than it could be with like a clay soil because the sand lets the water in, but once you get enough rain, well, even sand gets overly saturated. You may also consider planting trees in the berms of those swales or even in the swales themselves. That are large canopy, large widespread roots. You do want some taproot action in sand because big trees, you occasionally get snow even where you are, shallow root systems, sand, flop. But you want something with spreading and taproot system. And, you know, could it be a productive tree? Sure. Could it just be an ornamental? Sure. And if you eventually want animals, you're creating a silvopasture model now. The trees will reduce erosion, the swales will reduce erosion, and the polyculture Ben's recommending would reduce erosion. And he mentioned clover. I would definitely include clovers, plural, varieties, into that seed mix. And I would go a little probably over the edge with the diversity of cover crop. And look for things that are, like he said, naturally occurring. You know, it probably grows everywhere you are. Plantain and dandelion. And I would collect as much of that as you can because both are good forage herbs and forage forbs for your animals that you'll eventually have. But they are incredibly hardy. They pop up everywhere. And you've got one that is more of a hairnute structure and one that's more of a taproot structure, giving diversity of roots. So, like, add that to what Ben said, and I think you could be well on the way. Now, don't go do the earthworks thing unless you're sure about it. I haven't come out there, you know, I might look at it and go, no, don't do it here. But my gut is it's probably 80 to 90% likely that it would work for you. But take your time with it. Think about it. And remember, you can always add more, right? So if you started out with across a certain piece of the property, a two-swell system like that, then you could eventually add more. It'll be much easier to add more if it works than to take them away if you do not like the results. Because I'm always very leery of giving earthworks advice to a piece of property I haven't even looked at, let alone step foot on. So and then, you know, you say swell, and that doesn't mean it means to another person what you said. So that's why I try to explain it. Let's go ahead now and hear from Eric Hammond about installing air conditioning into a vehicle that doesn't have a broken air conditioning system. It doesn't have an air conditioning system at all.
Greetings, Eric Hammond here with an expert counsel question from R, who wants to know what a cheap, easy way is to add AC to a vehicle that originally did not have AC. The details to his question here is he owns a Transit Connect that did not come with AC. It's kind of his work van. He looked into getting this, had AC installed into this. And, you know, the factory option was just way too cost prohibitive. And he looked into modifying a motorhome AC and putting that in there. And that was going to be $1,000 or more. And that was too much. So he's just wondering if there was a cheap, easy way to put AC into something. You know, he goes on short trips and that's not a big deal. But every once in a while he takes these 10-hour drives and that's when he wants this air conditioning. So first things first, Transit Connect. He uses it as a work van. These are work vans that are based on a Ford Focus platform. So really they are a small vehicle with kind of a utility body on the back that's all connected. It's one airspace, but it's a very small airspace. So it could be air conditioned very easily just on the volume of the room, right? So when I think of air conditioning something, there's two things that come to mind. One, we have to cool the air, right? But two, we also want to remove the humidity from the air. When you look into a lot of the cheap options people use to try and, quote, air condition something, usually it's not removing the humidity. So you'll see solutions similar to like a cooler that you fill with ice and there's a fan in it and it blows cold, wet air out. It doesn't remove the humidity. So while the air is getting cooled off a little bit, you're not going to feel as refreshed as you are as if you were in an air-conditioned house or an air-conditioned vehicle where that humidity has been pulled out of the air. So thinking in my mind how this is a work van for you, I wondered about a solution of, can we just put an inverter in this van and then run a portable air conditioning unit? So I looked into the alternator output of this van. I typed in just a 2012. You didn't give me a year model. I looked up a 2012 Transit Connect. The specifications show that alternator puts out 88 amps at 500 engine RPM. So at idle, you can get about 1100 watts. And then at 2000 RPMs, the alternator can put out 150 amps or about 1890 watts. This is within parameters for putting an air conditioning unit in the back. So I'm thinking one of these portable AC units that you, you know, you buy them for your house and there's a an exhaust tube that you vent out a window, similar to that. So what's to say you couldn't put an inverter in your van? It's a work van. You probably want to use an inverter for running power tools and things like that anyway. So mount an inverter in there. I'd probably get a pure sine wave because things with motors tend to run better and cooler. Probably get like 2,000 watts. That would handle any surge current. I wouldn't mount it under the hood because that's going to be a hot environment for an inverter. But mount that thing close to the battery, and that'll really reduce the amount you have to buy in like big fat battery cables. And then just run a long cord for your 120 volts coming out of that to the very back. And I'm thinking you put this portable air conditioning unit in the back corner of your Transit Connect, just bungee corded in there. And then most vans, cars, trucks, they have vents in those back corners that are almost like a little flap. So if you pull the plastic off, you can probably see a vent where you can actually tuck that exhaust hose out of there. And I think that, you know, all the ones I've measured for these portable AC units were around 500, 600 watts. You'll want to get the smallest one you can find. You know, you could, they could maybe even go up to 700 watts, but I would get the smallest unit. And then I really think on your 10-hour drives, that would be sufficient. And then as a bonus, when you're not wanting the air conditioning, you could just take the bungee cord and pull that sucker out and use it in your house. It could do double duty. It doesn't have to stay in your van all the time when you're doing your short trips. And you also have an inverter mounted in your vehicle to run battery or run power tools, charge batteries, you know, whatever. It's a good idea to have an inverter in a car anyway. So maybe that's a possible solution to you. I can't think of anything that might be cheaper than that. I think you could probably pull that one off for sub 500 bucks if you scrounged together and got it done. But then you would maybe be making cool air and it would remove the humidity. I hope that helps get you started and get the wheels turning in your brain. If anybody else has any questions, go ahead and shoot them my way. Gas, diesel, electric, two-stroke, four-stroke, storing fuel, whatever. If it's broken and it should work, but it doesn't, give me a crack at answering it. Thanks.
Okay, so my only concern with this is what happens in an accident. So one, I would go with the lowest draw. Like we call them R2D2 air conditioners. We have two of them because we keep them upstairs. The rooms upstairs do not get it. Like, I have to freeze us down here to make people comfortable upstairs when they're guests. It's not that frequent. We have guests, so we just have these portable ones. And then if we need to run the generator, we can just go upstairs, grab them, bring them down. And like he was saying, they go in any window. They don't mount in the window. They freestand. And then they have a piece that slides in the window, an vent that takes the hot air out. So the exhaust needs to go outside. Otherwise, you're cooling out of one end and heating out of the other. That's how air conditioners work. And they work rather well. They do not have the cooling capacity of the smallest window mount air conditioner, though. They are not that efficient. So if there's any way that you could mount, like, the smallest window mount air conditioner, like, sticking... I know that it looks redneck as shit, but, you know, if you have a way that you could easily put it in and take it out, yeah, maybe you only use it when you need it. That's just another thought. And the reason he went, like, totally redneck creative here, the cost of doing this probably exceeds the value of, like, what the vehicle's now worth after you've done it. So one of my things is, like, let's say that I can sell a vehicle for $5,000 the way it is. It needs $3,000 worth of work. And after I'm done with the $3,000 worth of work, I can get $6,500 for the vehicle. I'm just going to sell the vehicle and buy something else. That is a no-win situation for me, unless there's some other parameters around it. Anyway, that's all I'm going to do on that. I want to talk today about why I feel a breakup of America is more likely than most realize today, and it has directly to do with the political climate. And that we are moving to a place where I'm not even talking about who's right or wrong here. I think you guys know that I always fall to the side of liberty, freedom, and individual independence. So I am more in line on many things with the right than the left, but I am also for social liberalness. In other words, people should be able to do what they want to do, but that doesn't mean you should be able to trans your kids. There's a limit on that as well, in my view. But I think I sit more towards the middle of the two extremes than most of America. And yet I find things that both sides do completely reprehensible. But, I mean, I'll just come out and say it. The most reprehensible shit being done in America today is being done by the left. And that tends to be the case in history. The more one moves towards socialism, the more one does horrible, atrocious things in the name of the greater good. And we have reached a point today where I think that both sides, though, look at the other side and they go, this is untenable. Like, this is why I say we're more divided. There may be not as many issues, or maybe not one issue as big as issues in the past. Let's say civil rights in the 60s, right? But there's more of them in total, and the untenable nature to the other side, the willingness of one side to see the other side is inherently evil, down to the individual, I think, is at an all-time high. And I have to say that some of it is so bad that I feel that way. I had a guy emailing me several times recently wanting to know why I even bother to talk about this transing kids thing, and it's not that big a deal. There's not that many of them. And, like, have you looked at a map of gender transition clinics for pediatrics in the country and how many just clinics there are? It's a lot, you know? But when you start giving hormones to 12-year-olds, when you start discussing transitional things with 5-year-olds, in my view, you actually are as evil as the other side is. But what's happened is I believe most of the people that are like, oh, yeah, that's okay, they don't really believe that. They've become so allegiant to their side that whatever their side says, they have to profess to believe because it's literally become a religion. And then we have this other side. You know, the right now is enamored with the orange man. And I can't say he wouldn't be a better president than Biden, because I really don't know who wouldn't, honestly. But it's this, like, they are willing to look the other way on every single bad thing about Trump. And I'm not talking about, you know, did he pay off Stormy Daniels? I don't give a shit who paid off who. I don't care. Like, this does not matter. It's not about classified documents, because that's just, again, I think it's lawfare. It's a travesty of our justice system. And it's going to play into this, by the way. A president can declassify anything they want to. That's, we know that. We have case law. We have other presidents that did the same thing, and they basically, their lawyers went and said, fuck you, he's a president, he can declassify anything, and including shit that was like in Clinton's like sock drawer or some shit. Stuff George Bush took. And there were discrepancies with the National Archives, but like, it wasn't a prosecutable offense, because constitutionally it's not, right? So I don't mean that when I say it. I'm talking about shit like Trump's bum stock bans. Trump saying shit like, can we get a hold of like Bill Gates or whoever runs the internet and just shut it down when we need to? Like, things that if any liberal said, the right would rightfully lose their mind. And so both sides have gone to a point where the other side is inherently evil, and their side must be defended even when it's wrong. This is a recipe for a country imploding and then exploding as it separates. Because there will never come a day where I am okay with somebody transing a child. And I'm more open-minded than most people about social issues. Like, there will never come a time where this is okay. Then the ease at which we can now put society into riots has it is so easy for such bullshit that there's nothing you're doing that's actually going to change anything, but yet now we have college campuses all over the country occupied, and let me tell you that soon it will spill beyond college campuses. This will be in the streets, this will be the BLM riots all over again. And so, again, remember what the purpose of those riots are. I talked about this before. It has nothing to do with Israel or Palestine, and if Israel or Palestine came to an agreement tomorrow, the people behind these riots would find a way to continue them. They would say it's not a fair deal. Whatever it took, which would not be much, to keep the useful idiots riled up, they'll do. Where do you see this healing? There's a lot of things that went on in the past that we were divided on, but there was a path to healing. There is no path to healing here. We also have the gun control debate ramping up, and this is something that the Second Amendment crowd is not giving an inch on this, nor should they. We're not giving 1 millimeter on this at this point anymore, and that side has been winning in court. Brewer, Heller, etc., over and over and over again, the courts have been saying, yeah, these guys are right. But they're not going to stop anyway. And if you get to the point where people, even before it happens, people feel that there will be goons going around gathering up the guns, it's on. It's civil war. But the other side doesn't see it as a constitutional violation. They see it as me sitting here owning guns is why children are dying in Atlanta. And as ridiculous as that sounds, remember, they thought me not wearing a mask while I went fishing during the COVID was killing people in Washington State. So there's also been a denouncement of logic and reason by both sides. So when you get to a point where both sides see the other side as evil, and logic and reason that conflicts with their beliefs is evil, you get to a point where there can be no mediation. between the two sides. Because there's nothing to mediate. There's no negotiation table to come to. One side, it used to be that no matter how bad we were divided about fixing the same problem. We just had different approaches to the problem. Scores in school are too low. One side wants higher standards. The other side wants more money. But the goal was common. Improve the performance of our schools. It was a fool's errand, because it's not the purpose of the system is what it does, but from a standpoint of societal cohesion, the goal was the same. When it comes to how do we handle things like trans rights, the right is like, be as trans as you want once you're an adult, leave children alone. And the left has been convinced that that is oppressive and evil. And so why do I bring it up to my special friend who needs to buy some helmet polish and a crayon sharpener? Because it's part of the fucking problem. And this isn't going away, and it is going to get worse. There is once, and it's in every aspect of our lives. When it comes to the economy, you have one side literally trying to convince you that the economy's great when everybody knows that it's not. And the cop-out by the left is what? America has the strongest economy in the world. First of all, that's a lie. We don't have the strongest economy in the world. We have the largest economy in the world. The largest and the strongest don't necessarily mean the same freaking thing. Who's stronger, the 200-pound bodybuilder or the 300-pound fat ass? We both know the answers to that, don't we? Right? We both know the answer to that question. So bigger does not equal stronger. There are countries right now that the financial stability of the individual, especially the middle class, lower class individual, is much stronger than it is for middle class, lower middle class people in the United States. So that's a lie. But even if it was true, it doesn't matter if it sucks. Being better than all the rest of the suck does not equal not suck. And the economy is only going to get worse. And we're $34 trillion in debt. And what is the solution from one side? The same solution they've always had. Tax the rich. It doesn't work mathematically. It doesn't work. It doesn't fucking work. If you took 100% of the wealth of the wealthiest people in this country, not only would you create a cascading effect of economic failure, because most of their wealth is in stock that they own in their own companies, which would all have to be sold to take their wealth. But if somehow you could do it, you can't run the fucking government on 100% of the 1%'s wealth for 6 months. Can't do it. What's the right solution? Cut taxes. That won't fix the problem either. It's not that I'm not for it, but it won't fix the problem. So you have an economic implosion that's coming while we have a societal divide at an all-time high where, again, both sides see each other as inherently evil, and there is no mitigation to this. There is no negotiation. I'm not negotiating with terrorists, right? And if you want to harm a child's psyche when they're 6 years old in fucking kindergarten, I am not having a conversation with you about this. Our special friend that emails me, the last time I responded to him, when he had one of his little tirades about this, I said, advocating at all, 1% for what you're advocating for, is reprehensible and disgusting. And I have no time for reprehensible, disgusting people in my life. In other words, you're not getting any more from me on this. You asked me a question, I gave you a logical answer a couple times. Now you're just still advocating for something that I find disgusting, and I'm done. And I'm more open-minded than the average person on this. And I'm still, on this issue, it's a no pass. You shall not pass. You shall not touch a child this way, emotionally, spiritually, or physically. You shall not. And we should all feel that way. So we have kind of like a righteous side on some issues. Some issues, both sides are delusional. And sometimes the righteous side is on the other side, by the way. I'm just saying. I don't see a healing path in this space. And so when this has happened historically, society bifurcates. And as it bifurcates, it becomes loyal to its side, even to the exclusion of individual morality and individual fidelity. meaning that a person on the left will pick up and run with a ridiculous idea like transiting children, or a person on the right who says they are for freedom and liberty will tolerate a president who talks about shutting down the entire internet through Bill Gates, or claims to be pro-Second Amendment and then bans a fucking stock that's an accessory, which I always told you would get banned, but it doesn't mean I'm okay with it. Right? That's what do you think of bump stocks? I think you're going to get banned. I said that long before Trump even announced he was running for president. The first time I shot one at SHOT Show, I think it was in 2010, I'm like, oh, these are going to get banned sooner or later. And people take that wrong. Like, oh, Jex, you're on their side. No, I'm not on anybody's fucking side with this asshole. I'm not okay with it. I'm telling you what's going to happen. Again, I'm the weatherman here. And as a weatherman looking at this storm, I see it degrading into violence. The right has been extensively restrained in this from a violence standpoint. The right is capable of violence at a level that the left cannot comprehend. Just from a standpoint of the materials and the knowledge that exists on what we would call the political right, not of the government, of the average American. But they are also far more restrained on the use of violence. What I've always said is the left is more prone to violence and the right is better at it. And all it's going to take is at some point enough leftist violence that it's going to be like a giant pressure valve being released on the right. And if that happens, by the way, it's exactly what your government wants to happen. You know, Maxine Waters, I want to know about these people associated with Trump that are somewhere up in the hills and where they're planning to invade if he loses. And let's go into that now. Why this could happen quicker than you think. There is no good outcome to the next election in regard to this problem. Let's look at it two ways. If Biden wins, it will be by the hair sliver of an ass hair, right? It will be like a fraction of the diameter of an ass. It will be incredibly close, even with cheating. You cheat like never before, right? Like, yeah, right? Bill Belichick, right? I saw you get that. Right? There'll be cheating. I guarantee you there'll be cheating in this election. The question is, will it be enough to overcome? No one will believe it. Any credibility left in the election process in the United States will die, even if he legitimately wins. Because the numbers are such, the sentiment is such, the response to, let's say, a Biden appearance versus a Trump appearance is such that no one really believes it last time. Trust me, even the left saying it was the most secure election of our lifetime, they're full of shit and they know it. They're okay with the outcome because they won. Two in a row? Who the fuck knows what comes out of the right in that situation? And it could be violent and it could be political. It could be a marked effort. It could be actually buy-in on a group of attorney generals and governors to say, we're done. We don't trust this process anymore. We're going to do our own thing. And that would be a coalition most likely led, and I know you think I'm biased because I live here, I'm just looking at the landscape, most likely led by the state of Texas. High probability of it, in fact. Now, let's look at the other side. The most likely scenario right now, according to Vegas odds makers, and they usually are right, is a Trump victory. Do you remember what it looked like the first time? What do you think it's going to look like this time? You have Democrat politicians telling the people that believe their words that he's going to put you in a camp, he's going to shut down the press, he'll never leave office, he'll stay forever. But there's no way to explain how, doesn't matter. They believe this. If you think the mental fucking shutdowns, breakdowns, violence in the streets were bad in after the 2016 election, wait if Trump wins after the 2024 election. And what's going to happen when I think that what you're going to get out of the Stormy Daniels bullshit is a non-guilty, right? Release, all goes. They're going to say somehow that Trump rigged it, that the judge would not, like, regardless of how weighted this is against him. So that will be bad, right? Even though it's the best possible outcome, because there is no crime there. Again, I'm not defending the man. I'm defending the system. There's nothing that Trump did that was illegal there. There's zero. I'm sorry if you don't believe it. There isn't. There is no crime in this. 38 freaking counts of nothing.
And the only reason it's being done, and see, I'm telling you, no matter where you fall politically, you got to look at the people around you in a disaster. And you're standing in the middle of a slow unwinding disaster. Okay? There's one side believes no matter what, this guy has got to go to prison. Doesn't even matter if he didn't do it. I know he did something, so whatever he goes down for, I'm okay with. The other side sees what's going on here. The prosecution in this case has brought witness after witness after witness after witness that does absolutely nothing to help the prosecution. What are they doing? They're dragging this fucking trial out as long as they can to keep Trump from campaigning and keep him under a gag order. The right sees this. When he gets convicted, if he gets convicted, then the right's going to lose their shit. Right? And then how many other things like this are there? A lot. And it's going to this is like the straw that broke the camel's back. The thing that eventually sets it off may be something that you would think, no. But you didn't have all the other shit, it would be one straw on the camel, and he wouldn't even notice it's there. But you can have that camel loaded down enough that, you know, the weight of a toothpick added is the end. And I think we are very close to that day. Does that mean I think you need to go buy a bunker or something? No. But I will tell you this. It's a good reason to come to Exit and Build and start following the process of Exit and Build. You need to get the fuck away from the places that will be, let's say, so left behind if that happens on the side you don't want to be on. And I think that's true of both sides. Like, if you're a blue dog Democrat and you like all this shit and you think I'm crazy and somehow you're still listening to me, get the fuck to New Jersey. Bye. Get out of here. Because you're not going to be happy either if this comes to be. We do not know what it'll look like. We don't know if it'll be violent, a lot violent, full-on warfare against each other, relatively peaceful the way the Soviet... We have no fucking idea. Anybody tells you they do, they don't know. They don't know. What happens if, like, the entire Mid-South joins together and says, fuck it, we're out of here? Do you start a war? Does the Brandon administration or whoever's in charge send in tanks? Is that tenable in this day and age? Do they try to diplomatically, like, how does this work? I don't know. And you won't know until it happens. But I will tell you that if you had been looking at the American Civil War coming and being obviously coming leading up to the election of Lincoln, the best thing you could have done in that republic would be moved to somewhere like Maine. And I'm telling you that I think that's a good strategy to take now and do it in a way that enhances your life even if it doesn't go wrong, like we've been teaching for 16 years. Anyway, with that, tomorrow we will have a Flashback Friday. I don't even know what episode that will be yet because I am no longer ahead of the game and I'll have to roll one of those out here as soon as I wrap up today so that I can have tomorrow off, and that should be fun for me. I hope you enjoy it too. And I want to remind you here at the end, if you like the show and the work that we do, please consider starting your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. I'm running the same item of the day today that I did yesterday, which are the galvanized raised beds from Vavor. There is still time to get gardens in this year, especially in more northern parts of the country. There is nothing that will get a garden in faster than being able to bolt some panels together, fill it up with dirt and plant it. So if you've wanted to put raised beds in, The 2 foot deep 4x8s are $96. The 1 foot deep 4x8s, which is a great depth for many of you, because all you have is more fill in the bigger box, and that's an expense or a labor thing. And if you're not worried about height, then the 1 foot is plenty of depth for most of you. Again, they're $47 a piece right now. That means you get two of them for under, call it $100 with shipping. And you can put those things together in about 40 minutes apiece. And you can be up and running, run some irrigation to them, start growing food. And you're going to need to be growing food in the future. I promise you, that is going to become more and more true over time. Last but not least, consider joining the Members Brigade. If you do that, you get exclusive discounts available only to members. If you are intrigued by the cannabis products that I mentioned today, again, that's just one example of about 70 different companies that do discounts. It is impossible for you to consciously make sure whenever you're buying something that if it's available from an MSV partner and you use it and use their discount, you won't get your money back. I really don't think it's possible to not get your money back. I will say I do have some customers for MSV that are like in Europe or Australia or something like that. And I know those discounts don't really work for you, most of them anyway, because most of the companies are American and they don't ship internationally. And so those of you that do that, I really appreciate you. I know that you're doing it just to support me, and thank you for it. But I also want to make sure that somebody listening right now in New Zealand, for instance, knows it probably won't do what I said it would do here in the States. Anyway, with that, I hope you guys have a great weekend. I will catch you, and we'll do it all over again starting next week. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.